Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust.
All right, it is May 2021. It's time for ASAP Nowcast. Let's dive into it. I did something I don't normally do as Editor-in-Chief of the magazine, and that is that I wrote an article and put my own article on the front cover. But I think it's okay. I'm looking for your validation and your acceptance of that, because I was pretty involved with all this stuff. This is about the ASAP Sepsis Task Force report. And that task force, which I should say I was not on, but I was present for some of the deliberations and definitely had a little bit of a front row seat and some back room access to what went down with the creation of the report that came out in Annals recently. And I also wrote an accompanying editorial in Annals about the ASAP Sepsis Task Force report. And I thought it was so important to talk about what it said that it needed to be front page news for ASAP Now, because for many years now, we as emergency physicians have been stuck with the CMS metric, the CMS SEP 1 metric that is not good. I'm sorry, it's not good. I just think it's not good. I think it has some good things. I think that it's important that we have something. I think we need to be screening for sepsis. I think there are a lot of ways to screen for sepsis. It is unacceptable to not screen for sepsis and to not treat and identify sepsis. But the CMS metric, the CMS SEP 1 metric, which really makes it so you have to do it, otherwise you get in trouble, you get dinged, right? I'm sure many of you get the nasty email, you didn't do the sepsis bundle. The way that metric was written and the way it works is it doesn't do it well. It really overtreats, it's clunky, it doesn't give you any exceptions. You got patients with a low ejection fraction, you got to give them fluids, although they're changing that. You got patients who really basically don't need anything and they're consigned to getting broad spectrum antibiotics because the people who wrote this bundle didn't really trust us, emergency doctors, to do this, even though we're the ones who do it all the time. And look, I'm not going to say that every person is perfect and that every emergency doctor doesn't need a little help with this. But what I will say is that there are many options for a good sepsis bundle that are different than the one that CMS rolled out. And so ASAP finally had a task force putting together really what amounts to a clinical guideline about sepsis for the general population, really. I mean, I think this is written for ER doctors, it's written for critical care doctors, it's written for government regulators who don't get it. And ASAP, the task force, which was led by Don Yeely, who, by the way, if you didn't know, like, Don Yeely was the lead author on the PROCESS trial. That was the most important, possibly the most important sepsis trial ever. It's certainly one of the top three or four, because after the early goal-directed therapy trial came out in 2001, really, people were left with the idea that protocolized care for sepsis was superior. And so that would lead people to think the sepsis bundle was necessary. Fast forward 10 years, and Don Yeely led a huge collaborative to look at that question. And as you probably know, they found that protocolized care really didn't make any difference at all. You really had to have a good sepsis screen. You had to really be on top of everything, but you didn't have to do cookie cutter medicine. And goodness, you shouldn't be dinged for not doing it. And so can't think of a better person to lead this than one of the great minds of emergency medicine and leaders in the sepsis field, Don Yeely. And so he assembled a group of experts from within the college, brought in stakeholders from all kinds of places. The Infectious Diseases Society of America, the Society for Critical Care Medicine, nursing teams and hospital teams, you name it. And there was a stakeholder at the table for these meetings, and ultimately led to this document, which really lays out what we know and what we don't know about managing sepsis. And I think it's a fantastic document. I'm so impressed with it. I wish I'd had anything to do with it. I really didn't. But I did get a chance to write about what I thought the strengths were in Annals, and therefore put it on the front page of ASAP Now. So again, I used the privilege to throw myself on the cover there, but really because I think it's an important issue that I've been studying for a long time. And it's really great that finally, after years on the sidelines, emergency physicians led by ASAP experts has grabbed the sepsis bull by the horns is saying, here's what the best care is, here's what you need to do, here's what you don't need to do, really changes things, right? You can do peripheressors. You don't have to put a central line, because what matters is the patient does well. And if you have a really good AC line, an 18 gauge or 20 gauge, you don't need a central line. You can get a patient on norepinephrine and that's totally fine. And there's no guideline out there really that emergency doctors refer to that says that's, I think, a really important thing to say. And it's also really important to say that lactate is not the same thing as sepsis. Okay, like a lactate of 2.1 is definitely not the same thing as sepsis. And at the end of the day, the ASAP policy here really talks about the fact that you don't always need to recheck a lactate. You don't, it's not really the same thing as sepsis. It's not diagnostic of sepsis. And I will mention that based on the work of the ASAP task force and my writing, ASAP actually developed a comment to the National Quality Forum and CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And what they said was, and what we said was, look, these sepsis bundles are being overly utilized because it's just crazy to have everyone with two SIRS criteria and a lactate of 2 be committed to this bundle. And based on some really great work by the Infectious Diseases Society of America, we thought that the best thing to do to make this simple was just to eliminate everything for anything under lactate of 4. So if you have a lactate of 4, sure, do the sepsis bundle, although even then, we think that it should be physician discretion on whether they can handle everything, the fluids and whatnot. But having it lactate of 2, really, that the denominator went way out of control. And so if you just limit the sepsis bundle to lactate of 4 plus infection plus SIRS, then maybe you will really have found the sickest patients and have done the right thing. How do we know that? Because lactate of 4 is what was studied. That is what was in the early goal-directed therapy trial. That was what was in PROCESS. That was what was in PROMISE. That's what was in ARISE. So really, this is just taking back the evidence. And I'm so proud that ASAP developed this task force, and I'm so proud that the documents that Yealy and his group came up with reflect the best evidence and puts emergency medicine expertise back at the center of the sepsis crisis. And I'm proud of the fact that we got to write a comment that has the potential, we hope, to change the sepsis protocols that the federal government is insisting upon. And we hope that'll happen this year, because this is 2021 is a year when the government, by way of the National Quality Forum, has to decide whether to re-endorse this bundle. And we are saying, and ASAP is saying, that we should only re-endorse that if it's limited to patients with genuine infection, SIRS criteria, and a lactate of 4. And even then, some physician discretion would be great, because not every patient needs the same thing. We just need to find these patients. We need to identify them and diagnose them and treat them. That's what we do. We, emergency doctors, we are sepsis detectors. We are sepsis treaters, and we are not sepsis over-treaters. We don't like the fact that we've been boxed into this, and hopefully this is going to be a moment where the tide turns. That's my hope, and that's what's on the front cover of ASAP Now in May 2021. Can you tell I'm passionate about this one? Can you tell? I've been, it's really, honestly, it's been 5 years of working on this. Ever since Scott Weingart, I was his resident, and I asked him, Scott, what's going on with these sepsis bundles? And Scott said, Faust, let's have a talk. And we sat down, we emailed, and I went down this rabbit's hole and really was shocked at what I found, which is that evidence-based medicine is not always as pristine as you thought it was, and people do things behind closed doors that's a little sketchy, and it ends up, if you don't show up to meetings and get a seat at that table, someone else is going to take that seat at the table and make decisions on your behalf. So it's my firm belief that we can actually treat all the patients with sepsis and identify them correctly, and we don't have to use such a broad net because we over-treat right now. And I'm not trying to miss any cases. Trust me, I'm not trying to miss sepsis. But I don't think we need to over-treat in order to do that. And now with ASAP's clinical policy, the guideline, we really have a great framework to do that. And it's really wonderful to see that work. And speaking of big policy things, also on the front page is the beginning of a conversation that's going to go on for quite some time. It's going to go on after my time as editor, and that is the ASAP for You workforce considerations. There's really a big debate about what to do with the workforce and how do we make sure there are enough jobs. Is it about controlling the number of residents? Is it about making sure scope of practice creep does not threaten our job security and also patient safety? Is it about making sure that everyone has a niche that they're happy with? There's lots of things, and I just want you to be alert to the fact that there's the beginning of this conversation, an article by the ASAP Board of Directors, but then coming up in the next few months, you're going to hear more about this, and there's going to be a really rigorous conversation that I anticipate will be very interesting. Next up, I want to talk about a really nice piece in the COVID space. This is called Counter COVID-19 Vaccine Hesitancy, and this is from the ASAP Diversity, Inclusion, and Health Equity section, and it's a really nice roundtable, and there are really five take-home messages. By the way, this was in the May issue, but honestly, this is going to be something that we deal with for a long time, and not just for COVID, but for other vaccinations. So five take-homes here. Avoid assumptions. You don't know why people are hesitant. Is it one reason or another? You might think it's because of a lack of trust. You might think it's because they had PTSD from anaphylaxis. You don't know, and you really have to avoid assuming that all people from all walks of life have the same reasons for their decisions, and you really need to tailor what they need to hear based on what their concerns are. Number two, consider the patient's unique circle, what I was just talking about. Number three, acknowledge what's called earned skepticism. There are people, there are communities who really don't trust the medical establishment because, quite frankly, the medical establishment has not done right by them individually or their relatives or just people are aware of history. If you've read about this country, you realize that not everyone has a rosy experience to draw on when it comes to having faith in the system. We know that we want medicine to be inclusive. We know we want medicine to be available for everyone equally. But frankly, it hasn't always been, and worse. In some situations we all know about, and I'll just, you know, mention Tuskegee, but there's so many others where medicine has harmed people, the medical establishment hurt people, and we need to overcome that by acknowledging the fact that some people may not be so thrilled to just listen to what we say without a little bit further of a conversation. I think that's totally reasonable. Number four, compassionate communication can build trust. Just the way you talk with people, it really changes the way the conversation goes. And I'll just give you an example. I had a really just kind of difficult situation the other day, and once I realized that the patient and I had something in common, just literally like where we had relatives who went to school, like we each knew someone from a certain part of the state. And once we landed on the fact that we shared some geography, literally, with our past, then we had a longer conversation. It was nice, and it was just, it made the connection. And so having this communication barrier be taken down by really showing that you see somebody as like a peer or an equal, that really can go a long way. All right, and then number five, make vaccine communication part of your routine. And that's just good knowledge because we're going to be talking about this so many times, whether it's slamming the door shut on COVID-19 or whatever the next crisis may be. I don't think necessarily it's the big Tdap crisis, all the tetanus shots we give out, but you never know. So I think it's just good to get in the habit of that sort of anticipatory guidance, but also get in the habit of us doing a little bit of laying of the groundwork to help our patients. And I just want to thank the members of the section who did this. This was the Diversity, Inclusion, and Health Equity section, and it was moderated by Tracy McIntosh and included the panelists Hugo Azenquelli, Pilar Ortega, and Robert Rodriguez. That is a very star-studded panel. So that's always great to have. That's what ASAP excels at. We bring great minds together. Next up, let's go to an article called Rethink STI Care, Start Treating Partners Too. And this is by Rachel Solnick, Melissa Fliegler, Larissa May, and Keith Coker. And the idea here is really to upend the standard approach to partner therapy with sexually transmitted infections, going from the standard approach, which is referring patients and telling them to tell their partners what happened and to get treated or tested, into the new idea, which is expedited partner therapy, or EPT. So let's go through the standard approach, which is the sort of patient referral method, and that is that the ED patient is diagnosed and treated by you. The ED patient is then supposed to notify their partner about the STI. The partner then makes an appointment with their health clinic, and that partner gets tested, and if they're positive, the partner can maybe come back or make a new appointment with that clinic, and then they get that appointment to get the prescription, or it gets called in if they're lucky, and then go to their pharmacy and they get the prescription filled, hopefully, and they get treated. A lot of steps. And so the idea is that expedited partner therapy could be a better way, because what happens in that workflow is the following. The ED patient is treated, the one in front of you, and they actually are given expedited partner therapy prescriptions for their partner to bring to them. And then the ED patient does still have to notify their partner, but at least they just say, okay, here's the prescription. The doctor already wrote it for you. And then the partner can take that prescription to a pharmacy to get it picked up. Eliminates a lot of steps to having to go get tested somewhere else and treated when the pretest probability is super duper high. And I think it's pretty great. It also comes at a time when we know that STIs are having a resurgence. The CDC actually had to revise its treatment guidelines for infections for the first time in a while. And they actually doubled the recommended cephalosporin dose, as I think you might all be aware of, that we're now using higher doses, and also replacing azithromycin for concurrent treatment for suspected chlamydia with doxycycline. I think there are some pros and cons to this approach, but I actually think that the real issue is that legally this is now being supported in a lot of states, and so you're not going to do this in a place where it's not supported, and especially where there's any exposure to treating patients who you haven't seen. But I think that the risks and the benefits are really, in most cases, not all, but in most cases, bending towards using expedited partner therapy, and that is going to decrease the downstream need for tests and appointments that are hard to get. So I'm on board. I think it was a great idea and something to consider and something to watch for in the future. I would not be surprised if this becomes a very commonly used approach. A couple of articles I wanted to mention, a little bit of a pediatrics aside here, abusive head trauma, and this is for kids in the Forensic Facts. This is written by Ralph Riviello and Heather Rotzi, and they always do a nice job of helping us with difficult cases. Just check that out. And also, while we're on the case of kids, the Kids Corner, that's with Landon Jones and Richard Cantor. And two articles, they often do two. The twofer here is one about whether it matters what solution you use if you're actually refilling a G-tube balloon in a kid. And it turns out that, I love when this happens, that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you use saline. It doesn't matter whether you use sterile water. They tested these things for weeks and found really no difference. So the fail rate is really the same no matter what. So nice to always have that in your back pocket, that it matters that you do something, that you fill these things up, but not exactly how. That's always nice. And the other one was about whether or not diarrhea and appendicitis really go together. I thought that was kind of surprising, because I think some people think that if there's diarrhea, maybe there isn't acute appendicitis, and therefore the presence of diarrhea may not eliminate the possibility that it's appendicitis. It's an interesting thing. I think that appendicitis is one of those diagnostics that's quite hard to do. We have whole decision tools about that, and they aren't good enough. So the best thing is for you to be at the bedside and try to figure it out. And here's another example of that playing out in the evidence-based medicine literature. And speaking of twofers, let's do a little twofer on some trauma topics. The first coming from Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, Dr. Ken Mill, my good friend. Admission decisions in rib fracture cases. And the question is, can spirometry help assess patients with multiple rib fractures and really help us with understanding disposition? And surprisingly, it's possible, right, that spirometry measurements early in the hospital stay might predict the ultimate discharge home, and this could allow for immediate or early discharge. Obviously, that's what the authors of the article in question think, but Dr. Milne, being the skeptic that he is, goes through some of that and concludes, maybe, but there's not enough high-quality evidence for us to use that as a guide by itself. But I did think that there was a nice little Western Trauma Association rib fracture algorithm to refer to, because there is some simple things that really can help your cognitive unloading. I like that one. We can just have a quick rule to go by that makes a lot of sense. So, patient with more than two acute rib fractures, which is another way of saying three or more. That's the people we're talking about. If they have three rib fractures and they are older than 65, they're pretty much going to the ICU unless otherwise stated. Like, that's the default. If they are under 65, then the question is, like, how are they doing? Do they have respiratory compromise? Do they have really bad rib fractures with any evidence of underlying parenchymal damage? Those folks might also go to the ICU. But after that, if not, it's really a matter of pain control. And so that's where it gets interesting. So I thought that was a nice framework. 65 plus, you know, three rib fractures, they're probably going to the ICU. I like that. And if not, then really, if they're not really compromised, then it's really about pain control. And I think that's something that we could probably do better at. We could probably do better pain control and get these sort of middle-aged patients home, because really, what are we keeping them for unless they really have signs, really good, hard signs that something is going on that needs to be monitored. All right, so the other part of the twofer is the Dr. Hellman, Anton Hellman's EM cases. Gosh, the Canadians really seem to own the trauma space lately here. I guess that's with all that snowmobiling they do. Or snow machining, what do they call it? Anyway, massive transfusion protocols, hemorrhage protocols. Dr. Hellman walks us through some really important things about that. I will not spill the beans here because we are at time, but check it out because it's a great twofer. Dr. Hellman always bringing us great pearls from the literature and keeping it real from Canada. All right, that is the most of what's in the magazine, although I can never get to everything. We've got more news from the college. We've got more policy prescriptions from Cedric Dark, your future editor-in-chief, and just lots of great stuff. So check out the May issue. It's in your mailbox. It's also in your email inbox. It is also on the interwebs and the internets, or whatever you want to call it. And these are great resources both for a little review for your board recertifications, your next shift, or just keeping up great teaching tools. There's so many ways that I find this magazine still is so useful in the print version. I love the print version. I'm so old school that way, even though everyone thinks I'm like a Twitter guy. And I am, but I love a good old-fashioned handheld magazine. Love that, and it looks great thanks to the team that we have with our publishers and with ASAP Now. So thanks for listening, and see you next time.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.